Welcome to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thanks for joining me here for Productivity Book Group's discussion of Mindset, The New Psychology of Success by Dr. Carol S. Dweck. A little bit about the author and the book. First, this is all being pulled, by the way, from Amazon's descriptions, so do credit there. Carol S. Dweck, PhD, is a widely regarded leading researcher in the fields of personality, social psychology, and developmental psychology. She has been the William B. Ransford Professor of Psychology at Columbia University and is now the Lewis and Virginia Eaton Professor of Psychology at Stanford University and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Her scholarly book, Self Theories, Their Role in Motivation, Personality, and Development, was named Book of the Year by the World Education Fellowship. Her work has been featured in publications such as The New Yorker, Time, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. And she's, of course, appeared on Today in 2020, and she lives with her husband in Palo Alto, California. So she's also a Californian there, Linda. a little bit about the book from the book description on Amazon. After decades of research, world-renowned Stanford University psychologist Carol S. Dweck discovered a simple but groundbreaking idea, the power of mindset. In this brilliant book, she shows how success in school, work, sports, the arts, and almost every area of human endeavor can be dramatically influenced by how we think about our talents and abilities. People with a fixed mindset, those who believe that abilities are fixed, are less likely to flourish than those with a growth mindset, those who believe that their abilities can be developed. Mindset reveals how great parents, teachers, managers, and athletes can put this idea to use to foster outstanding accomplishment. This is the updated edition that we're going to be talking about, where Dweck offers new insights into her now famous and broadly embraced concept. And so with that, let's get the conversation started with just understanding the way the book is organized. The book has 8 chapters where she talks about the different mindsets. She makes her way through explaining the mindsets more in depth in chapter 2. She talks about the truth about ability and accomplishment in chapter 3. She then covers particular paradigms, kind of areas of human activity, sports, business, relationships, and then what parents, teachers, and coaches can do regarding those mindsets. And that's chapters 4 through 7. And then she talks about changing mindsets in the final chapter. So let's start off discussion with, what were your initial thoughts? What were your initial experiences as you read Mindset, The New Psychology of Success?
Yeah, I'll jump in. Of course, and I come from the background of education where, you know, our whole business is thinking that that students can improve, that they can be better, that we're sort of the great equalizer rather than the talents or ability that they bring with them. So this, you know, really plays well into what great teachers are always thinking, and the good ones, you know, can point to student after student after student after student that maybe didn't experience success other places, but they flourish in one particular classroom, in one particular subject, sometimes much to the amazement of other people.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that there was a time when we started off thinking that we should just praise students, call them smart, call them talented, and somehow they would flourish in that perspective. And it turns out that from the research, Dr. Dweck has uncovered this really fundamental piece, which is that when we tell children that they're smart and talented, without praising them for effort and for strategy and progress, they fail more often. And I think this is really important for not only educators, but I think for those of us who are aware of our own performance and want to enhance in that space, that we need to make sure that we're not holding tight to those things that we once heard. I mean, I know this very, very personally. I was raised in an environment where I was the smart kid, and my parents always identified me as that. I'm 1 of 6. And when you're the smart child in a family and everyone has high expectations of you, it's very difficult when you fail, because it takes you completely out of psychological safety. Your safety net is gone immediately as soon as someone tells you that you have to study for a test. Otherwise you'd fail, because no, I'm intelligent. I don't need to study. You know, those things really compromise you when you start to see any chinks in the dike. And so I had to learn very early on that when I did fail and I didn't put in effort, that was why, as opposed to not just the effort, but also my intellect was at challenge, right? And connecting those two pieces of the puzzle was very difficult for me and took a lot of emotional, healing over time. But I wish someone had told me that up front, that, you know, it had nothing to do with my intellect, it had nothing to do with my smarts, it had everything to do with the amount of work that I put in that meant more to my ultimate success on the other side. Anyone else with initial thoughts?
It's almost like, increasing self-confidence also increases ego fragility.
I would be curious whether that's true. I don't know that confidence necessarily is in, in particular areas, right? We can think about them in very, very specific areas.
Yeah, I think I'm speaking specifically with that fixed mindset idea where you're praising a particular person. It's not even insincere, but it's just that you're focusing on the wrong thing. And as you yourself described, you get stressed, you get worried as there's this performance thing that is based on some wrong-headed thinking, that fixed mindset versus the open mindset where it's all potential to learn.
Right. And people respond so very differently to when they feel their intelligence challenged. In my case, it was definitely, emotional. It wasn't responded in terms of lacking and wanting to go back out there and do more work. Thankfully, I just have that charge associated with it. But I know that for me, it was then an inward low mood problem, right? So then I would get depressed. I would feel all of that internal turmoil that wasn't good for me, even though I would continue to keep kind of operating. And I think that it was very damaging, and I don't feel, I don't blame my parents. They were doing the best they could with what they had, with what they knew at the time, right? You do what you can. But if I had been told up front that effort mattered way more in the long term, in the next 40, 50 years of my life, I would have never even given thought once to my intellect and to all of the talk around me that was constant. I mean, like I always heard it. And to this very day, if you ask my mom, she'll tell you very plainly, oh yeah, he's the smart one. And she doesn't quite get it. She was just raised in that space, right? Where you praise your children for what talents they show up front. And she thinks that that's the only piece for it. And I don't think she's actually a fixed mindset. I really don't think she is, but that's how it goes. Brad, you had a thought you wanted to share?
Yeah. So I read the book about over a decade ago. And then I've just been keeping up with what Carol said. And it had an impact on me when I read it. I checked it out of the library and it was like, I kept the book for a couple of months and stuff. And just the connection with like identity and ego development, and even Albert Bandura's ideas with self-efficacy. He's at Stanford, Albert Bandura, that kind of thing. And even Angela Duckworth's work on grit. So all of these things kind of go together, even though they're different researchers and different things. It's kind of fascinating to see how all these kind of streams connect.
Yeah, Duckworth's at UPenn, I think. So.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, absolutely. Linda?
Well, I was just going to say what you were talking about. I think there's a difference between praising the child and praising what the outcome or what is the product, and the identification we have with product with self, like what we produce is us. So therefore it has to be something particular. Otherwise it's a reflection on us. And I think that part of people not getting that straight when we're children and telling us, oh, you're smart, instead of this is really fine work that you've done. I'm very impressed with your work. I'm very impressed with what the way you're performing is really good, as opposed to saying you're very fast, or whatever if it's sports or whatever. But I think that focus on praise being focused on who you are, as opposed to you're worthy because of these traits that you have, as opposed to just focusing on, hey, let's focus on what we see and what we like about that, as opposed to saying it's some kind of identification with yourself that you're good or bad because of your talents or whatever.
Exactly. And that's what Dr. Dweck is really trying to get at, which is that when we praise children for things that they inherently don't have control over, they're going to feel less capable of experiencing what locus of control they have. And so if we reward and praise for effort, strategy, and progress, which are the three areas she really focuses on telling folks to, we're going to be far better off. And so that, of course, works and helps in raising and rearing and teaching children, but we're all adults. And unless anyone listening to the podcast is a real youngin, the rest of us listening are adults also. So I'm really curious in terms of, from the book's perspective, what can we all do to use this material? What can we actually gain from knowing this in our own worlds? And of course, the book touches on these different areas, right? You know, sports performance, in our business and professional lives, and our relationships, you know, especially if you are of the growth mindset perspective or learn to be growth mindset oriented, and you live with someone who is perhaps fixed mindset oriented. talking for a friend. You know, you need to be mindful of how you can use these tools to be more productive and you know, not just with yourself, because there is a lot of self discussion and self dialogue that needs to happen in terms of moving from fixed to growth mindset, even in areas where you might feel like, I'm actually of the opinion that we all have fixed and growth mindsets based on particular categories of our lives. And so in one area of your life, you might think you're very fixed, or you might be very fixed. And in another area, you might be very growth mindset oriented. And so we have to have this ongoing dialogue of challenging ourselves to say, what can I learn? What can I do? How can I grow in this particular area? And so I'm just curious, what areas of your own world and life do you feel like you are perhaps more growth mindset oriented or more fixed mindset oriented? And how would you transition yourself to a more growth mindset perspective? And for everyone's edification, right? So fixed mindset is you believe that you have a fixed set of traits that are unchanging. And growth mindset means that you can develop your abilities through effort. That's really the clear differentiation or contrast between the two. What areas do you feel like you are fixed or growth, and how would you change that?
This is Lee. I'll jump in. I have had to have a growth mindset for work for my entire career. I'm an IT person, and I've worked in all kinds of roles, from hands-on technician to various leadership roles. And the technology changes so much that even if you're staying within the same company or even the same job, what you get to do requires you to keep learning things all the time. I mean, lifelong learning is a wonderful thing anyway, but in the technology field, it's a survival trait. You cannot succeed without constantly learning new stuff. And so you have to have the growth mindset that, okay, I don't know how to program in this language, but now I have a project where I'm an expert in it, whether I am or not, and I have to go learn it. So you have to stay in the growth.
It's really interesting. I've heard over and over again in the software development field that engineers think about themselves being either good at their own personal productivity systems or bad at it, but that the work itself challenges them to kind of self-organize. There's a structure that's usually provided by the environment that they work in, whether that be, you know, they work in an agile scrum environment where they are forced to basically have this output. So it's like the structure from the organization provides them a personal level of organization. And it sounds to me like what you're saying is that also having to keep up to date with regard to the languages kind of also forces you into that perspective as well. It's something that I'm fascinated by and consistently paying attention to as I see different industries that are that perpetuate good parts and have perpetuate bad parts too, but you know, mostly perpetuate good performance parts.
So there is at least historically a bad part on the mainframe. Lots of people defined them. The mainframe, when people started working in programming on the mainframe, it was a black art. And it was a very small minority of people. And so people tended to identify heavily with what they did and their specific skills in that area. And it's been a very interesting thing as folks got to my age. Lots of folks had a very fixed mindset around I can't learn this new stuff. And it was a real challenge to keep people, to move people out of that fixed mindset.
I think I can share. I just had a fixed mindset experience just a couple minutes ago. I'm taking a lunch break here and have my work laptop next to me in the inbox, and I got an email from somebody that I'd not met yet and saw in their signature block after their name a whole bunch of different initials and letters and stuff. And I'm thinking, oh, there's somebody who's got to show what they've done, as opposed to saying, hey, here's somebody new with a lot of experience. I bet I can learn something from him as he learned something from me.
You actually bring up a very, very good point, and it's something that I actually do pay attention to, is people's email signatures and whether they put their credentials everywhere and anywhere they can, you know, and it's very interesting to see who puts what where. And so I'm just, as a quick side note, just administrative note, for those who are dialing in by phone, you can use *6 to unmute yourself if you do want to join the conversation at any point. So *6. And back on to the conversation, I'm really curious if you experience this with others. So it's one thing to see yourself in and to do self-analysis, you know, and it's another to kind of identify it from others. But I'm curious what and how you see others around you with fixed and growth mindsets. And not just to like pick on people. I don't want you to think about like, oh, I see this person, they're a fixed mindset and that's negative, because that can actually be a very protective layer for them, kind of like myelin sheathing in your brain. You know, like people will hold to a fixed mindset because it's what they know, and it gives them a sense of comfort. And maybe they don't want to grow in that particular area, and that's perfectly fine. But don't think about it more from someone's good or bad, but more from the negative and positive experiences you have with people who have fixed or growth mindsets. I know that for some people who have growth mindsets, they sometimes forget that the ground is hard. And so they just keep hitting the ground, and they forget that at some point they're going to break a bone. You know, that bruising is one thing, but breaking bones is harder and to heal from. And so, you know, we do have to remember that there are kind of boundaries to all of this, even when we think about the growth mindset being something powerful and useful to us. And so I'm just curious about what your own personal experiences were, as Derek noted, of coming into contact with people who might be fixed or growth mindsets, and some of the pros and cons there.
Well, I'll jump in there, Ray. I think really here, as with so many other things, there are extremes, and the extremes are the ones to avoid. And that, as Ben Franklin used to talk about, the moderacy in all things. So, you know, just as we don't want someone just stuck saying, you know, it can't get better, I can't do this, I can't do that. We also don't want to be with that person that says, I can do anything. You know, the one that says, I have on my Superman cape, therefore I can jump off the house and I can fly. Well, no, you won't. There needs to be a balance between the two. So the people I interact with, I'm sort of looking for that. I don't want that eternal optimist where nothing can possibly go wrong, or the one that nothing can possibly go right.
I always say that I delude myself on the side of positive, right? Which is that there's negative in the world. I'm not completely bothered by the fact that there's negative in the world. I know it exists, but I'm not going to lean into it. And so, you know, if I'm going to be delusional in one end, I'm going to go toward the Don Quixote side. So not to the point of delusion, right? But like just positively deluding myself just a little bit on that side so I can stay positive. And I think that's what keeps me mostly optimistic. Danny, you wanted to say something? Go for it.
Yeah, I found it interesting that Professor Dweck kind of downplayed CBT, but as compared to the more expansive ability of looking at mindsets, though in a way it also made sense. Like, CBT is like the emergency room where you're really addressing an immediate need, and that, more demanding mindset that is impacting you emotionally, whereas the mindsets, looking to move toward a growth mindset, is more about the long-term treating of a disease as opposed to a close-in wound that an emergency does. So I got on board with her once I saw that. I was at first a little negative about her and just saying that, no, cognitive therapy is, you know, insufficient compared to what I'm talking about. And I think it's really, they both have their place.
I would fully and completely agree. I think that one of the things we have to understand that is, like, in the Beck world, which is Dr. Aaron Beck, you know, the progenitor of CBT, you know, the whole thought was to be able to help someone who was, you know, mentally unwell, and helping someone who is in a state of unwellness. We tend to think about this from, like, if you chopped off my arm right now and saw me gushing blood, you'd be like, oh my gosh, let us help him. He is gushing blood. You know, let's get him to a hospital. We think about mental health and we think, you know, he's not feeling well. He should just buck up. He should just go get himself better. You know, maybe take a day off. Like, we don't quite think about mental wellness, mental health in the same way. And there is a pervasive problem there. And so, Beck, and I put a note here for the Feeling Good Handbook by Dr. Burns, who is an acolyte of Dr. Beck. And, you know, we need to start thinking about this from the perspective that there is, as you said, Derek, kind of like this is the triage necessary to help stabilize people and ultimately help them over time work themselves out of it. But Dweck is really talking about something that's not only about being curative, it's all about also about performance enhancement. It's about making people better once they are stable. And that can't be counted out as less or counted as less because we have to think about it from the perspective that if you make me resilient over time, I'm going to be ill less. That from my physical, biological health, and also my mental health. And so resilience is really the point here. And I think that Dr. Duckworth talks about this a little bit in terms of grit. You know, and this is where some of these pieces start to kind of blend over one another. But, you know, we really need to consider both the immediate treatment for people who are unwell, and then, of course, the long-term benefits of building resilience, building a protective sheathing around our mental capabilities. And that allows us to be not only better, but also protected as well. Linda, go for it.
I was just going to say there's a lot of fixed mindset about mental health, and that once you have a episode of not feeling well, cutting your arm off is not a good analogy for this, but let's say you broke your arm. We're going to get you to the hospital and get it taken care of. And you're not forever the person who broke their arm. And that's what defines you, and that's all there is to you, and you're just the broken arm person. But with mental health, if you have any kind of crisis, you're forever that person in our society. There's a very fixed mindset. That's the way you are for the rest of your life, and there's no fixing it. There's no changing. There's no growth. It's just you are what you are, and you're stuck with it. So I think that's a problem, I think, that needs to be fixed, because a lot of people would probably grow much more quickly if there wasn't this idea that there's something wrong with you if you seek assistance when you have a mental issue.
Yeah, I'm of the opinion that everybody should have some kind of counselor or therapist who can help them and guide them in life, just the same way that you would think about getting a fitness coach or a nutritionist or registered dietitian to be able to help you with your nutrition, the same way you would have a doctor help you with your ongoing regular checkups every year, a dentist, ophthalmologist or optician who helps you with your eyes. I mean, we don't see problems with it in that world, but there's such a stigma as it relates to mental wellness that I think people really don't get it. And I think, you know, to Hillary and Derek's point, I think it's really important for us to really try to shut down those barriers and break down the barriers and have more open dialogue about it. I mean, you know, I've probably noted this on the podcast before, you know, but struggling with depression is a very, very common thing. And when we do, many times, just like with anything else, I too had a fixed mindset around it, right? You know, something about me is broken, and therefore I can't fix it. And therefore, you know, that's just the way I am. And thankfully, I came into Dr. Dweck's material very early on. And so, I was able to understand that, you know what? No, I'm not broken, you know? And yes, being pilot. Go ahead, Linda. Yeah.
I'm just going to say, but if we all were equipped with the tools to help you with any kind of mental, you know, that kind of fixed mindset of there's not something wrong with me, or, you know, the things that people get into when they are depressed or have other mental health issues. If we taught the tools to everyone, we could prevent people from going so deep. And if there wasn't stigma around it and everybody had the tools, there would be a lot less of it in society, I think, because people would be able to preemptively help themselves before they got so bad they need, you know, serious help.
Right. And people would be more aware faster that there was something going wrong. And that's my issue, is that so many times the problem is more severe than it needed to be because I wasn't aware. You know, I'm more than happy to step in and say, hi, do you need to talk? You know, and just having a one-to-one with someone who's in my life, you know, one of my siblings or my parents or a friend or a peer or something like that. I have no problem with spending 15 minutes if it means, you know, someone's life being better. And we just don't share enough, you know, and I'm actually a particularly private person, so I don't share enough just generally. I don't like people to know things about me. And so, you know, I'm in the wrong world being who I am. Everybody, you know, knows me, they can Google me, but you know, it's like, I'm still fairly private. And so it's very difficult for me to share. And I know that in many ways is something that other people do and have to, you know, kind of break down that first layer of protective, you know, coding because of society, you know, because of society's ills toward anything that makes you think that you are mentally unwell or unfit in some way, shape, or form.
And we in society say it's okay, but we don't act like it is. So people don't believe that little talk that people say that, oh, it's fine if you're mentally ill, you should seek help. But we don't act like that. We treat people differently once they are diagnosed with a mental illness. And if that changed, then people wouldn't be afraid to talk about it. I mean, I was in a funk yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I can say I was in a funk. And I know now why I got into a funk. And I just treated myself really well. I said, you know what, you're in a funk, just chill out and find out what's wrong. It'll come to you. But don't push yourself beyond the funk. And the funk is now gone. But I didn't abuse myself about it, which I think our society likes to encourage.
yeah, absolutely. And we need to arm others, you know, so that everyone, including children, are taught skills for being able to provide comfort and compassion in those environments. And we just don't have that kind of care treatment. I know that I don't. You know, I'm probably a little bit more educated about this stuff considering my background. And I know that in my own personal life, I don't practice it as good as I could or as well as I could. It's just very difficult to step up and say, okay, I'm going to bring the better part of myself to the table. There's so much societal stuff that makes you want to say, you know what, we can set aside the emotion right now and we can focus on the logic and be, you know, we can focus completely on the things that are logical and then set aside the emotional stuff. And really, if we actually brought the emotional stuff back to the fore, we might be able to solve it and that problem wouldn't be here over and over again. I wanted to talk about some of the ways in which we deal with this in kind of our own performance and productivity systems. What ways can we invest in this understanding of our fixed and growth mindsets so that we're able to be more productive? That's the name of the game here at Productivity Book Group. So what and how can we add this into our ongoing either personal development plans, into our own professional development plans? What can we do here to use this material wisely going forward?
Well, from growth mindset, just starting out with my weekly review, you know, David Allen's Getting Things Done weekly review, there's things that you're going to see that need to be better. You need to do better and just say, hey, here's an opportunity. How can I, you know, fix this sort of thing? How can I actually more successfully do my weekly review? But what, you know, systems do I need to put in place or process in order to better address this or that? So it's that open-ended piece of growth as opposed to beating yourself up that you didn't you didn't stick to your context as much as you should have and built too many to-do lists or something.
And I think it's important to, you know, to narrow things down. Probably all of us, if we started to list all the ways in which we could get better, it would be a very long list. But to just take two or three.
I can show you mine.
We'll just take, you know, two or three to concentrate on. And with, you know, with what can I do today to move this thing a little bit forward? Who are the people in my life that I could reach out to who could help me do this? You know, there's the old reticular activating filter. You know, you buy a red car, and then all you see on the highway are red cars. You know, you start to, all of those things that are out there start to become obvious to you. So I think when you start to identify, this is where I want to get better, the world kind of conspires to help you.
I just actually just did this for my productivity, but of not looking at it as an improvement, but as a growth, which to me are two different
nice
ways of thinking about it. So I don't need to be improved. I'm fine the way I am, but I would love to grow. I want to expand. I want to do more. I want to be able to do, I want to be better, not better. See, I'm so entrenched in that idea that there's something wrong with me and I need to fix myself. But I'm really had that switch this morning because I was working on planning my next 12-week year, and I looked at it and said, I'm all about there's something wrong with me. You know, I had a doctor's appointment on Monday, so I was all about something's wrong with me. And I said, no, I'm going to make a focus on growth. How can I have a real positive? And I am a born again optimist because I spent 99% of my life being a pessimist. Yes. So now I'm an optimist and trying to be an optimist. But I really see a big difference there between that growth and improvement. And if you can switch over to that growth and get away from this idea that there's something wrong you need to fix, that is a fixed mindset that we're somehow flawed.
I love the language that Linda used. And I think that's something that we can use with other people. You know, if you're a manager, to say to your other people, you know, if I say, here's the area where you can improve, well, that makes it sound like you're just not that good. You know, you need to get better. You're below the line. But if we want to grow you, that sounds like, wow, I'm important to the organization. I have a future here. I'm promotable. Yes, I'm on board. I want to grow.
Yeah, I always say that I was thankful, at least from the perspective that my mother would always say that you're a whole person. There's never a part of you that's not whole. And so it's interesting how you're like I'm a whole person in the sense that I'm a unique individual, right? And I think it's really important for people to understand that you can grow, you can develop, but there's no lacking in me. Like I've always felt full. I've always felt like my life is full. And I don't know how to pay that forward necessarily in terms of explaining that feeling to others, that sense that I don't feel at any point in time that I was ever not good enough, because I've definitely felt that, but that I've never felt like there was some part of me that wasn't enough to be fully me, right? You know, there's like that little kind of internal feeling that there's just something there. And I feel like they're two different pieces to me in that sense. I don't know how to explain it, but it definitely comes to resonance of that piece that like, you're not void. You're born into the world fully capable. And to want to grow from there, you're at 100%. And what Linda's talking about is going to 105 or maybe going to 110. And that feeling inside of me has always been there with all of the challenges. And I think that's really, really good for you to have where you're getting to that perspective and using it, I think absolutely key.
Well, you are paying it forward, Ray. I mean, you have done that with me. You've called me on it when I've abused myself on calls, and you are paying it forward because you believe it. So the fact that you believe it about yourself, you believe it about others. And so others get that from you, and you don't have to articulate it in any other way other than just living it.
Well, good. I'm glad to model at the very least. So other ways in which you are capable of using this material in your productivity system. And I'll preface this with just a way that I have. So I was jokingly saying to Dr. Buck that, you know, I'll show you my list. But I actually do have a list because, you know, I'm a GTDer, that's what I do. And so I created a list of areas, systems to optimize. And I consider this optimization, right? You know, the system is good, but it can be better. And I'm fine with that language. I guess I'm still steeped in that world, but you know, like optimizing is how I see it. And so I will look at any particular system during my weekly review, and if I see some way in which it could be better, I will track it on that list and then decide what system is needed or what subsystem is needed for myself to grow. how do I get better in that capacity? And that's been really useful for me because it's a cue. It's not all immediate active stuff. It's all someday maybe, right? So in my case, it's a someday. And I know that if I decide that some part of me needs to be optimized, some part of me needs to grow, I can then say, okay, that's on the list and I'll get to it. But I don't have to worry about it anymore because I've got it tracked and maintained out of my head in a system that I trust. And I know that when I'm ready to deal with it, then I will elevate that to an active project or some active, system, part of my system, and create a subsystem to be able to support myself there. And so that's been really useful to me, is just to start to become aware of the areas where I might have certainly fixed mindsets, and then where I then recognize that I can grow in that area. Tracking and maintaining that list of growth opportunities has been really useful for me. So just having that list. It also helps in tools. So there are just certain parts of my system that are functional tools where I say, oh, you know what? This Zapier Zap that I have set up is not working. It does some part of the piece, but it's not facilitated in keeping me. So I will then also track those systems that are technological based and where they're maybe not working the best and keep track of those as well. So that's sort of helpful, not growth mindset oriented, but just like I try to keep a track of those stuff to optimize, and those two lists run concurrently. The things that are me that need to be worked on, and then the stuff that's outside of me that are external that need to be worked on as well.
So Stephen Hayes is a psychologist, and he created acceptance and commitment therapy, which is kind of CBT along with mindfulness. And I'm reading his latest book. I'm just a couple of chapters into it, but it's called A Flexible Mind. And what he sees is like is psychological flexibility. He says that this is like a key trait that he sees in people. And that I was just connecting that to the growth mindset, about how key psychological flexibility and the growth mindset are connected. The psychological flexibility is that you don't see yourself as being fixed psychologically, basically, and how that intersects with Carol Dweck's work.
Yeah, we have to remember that, like, grit and perseverance, and what you're really talking about, which is what they call resilience, and that kind of perspective. They're different things, but there's so much overlap that we have to remember that there's, like, growth is different than resilience, which is different than perseverance or grit, but they all work to actually create, you know, a better you. So I think that's all great, but a great book suggestion. So Dr. Hayes' work is good. Anyone else? Thoughts?
And when I was progressing through the business section of the book, I couldn't help but also think about appreciative inquiry from organizational improvement. And I actually, before the session here, I Googled Dweck and appreciative inquiry in the positive psychology movement. They almost run in parallel. There's a lot of overlapping associative work, and I think a lot of the vocabulary she uses is in line with appreciative inquiry and seeks to have the same sort of goals at an organizational level, but can also be brought down to a personal level.
Right. And anyone who's interested, you can look at, David Cooper Ryder's work on appreciative inquiry. So definitely worth checking out.
Well, it reframes failure. So failure isn't the end of the process. Failure is just part of the process. So I think that way, I mean, failure isn't like you stop because it's not working. You take that in as learning, basically.
Yeah. And there's two levels there, right? So think about, we don't always fall. Right, we sometimes stumble, and we forget that the language that we use about what we're doing when we're working towards something is also important. And so I frequently have to when I'm talking to a client, I'm always like, wait, you just said that you failed in this business, but the business is still alive, and it's like it's not over. It's still a going concern, so it's not a failure because then you just shut down the business, right? So no, it's actually the business has stumbled, right? It may be handicapped in some way, shape, or form, but we now start from that basis that you've stumbled, and like any person, when we stumble, we then right ourselves and bring ourselves back upright. When we fall, and you know, we take the hit and we figure out how to get back up and brush ourselves off and move on. Remember that they're kind of different stages of tripping up, so to speak, to keep the analogy going. Frank.
Yeah, and it's the ability to say, not yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dr. Dweck talks about that that phrase of using the not yet or yet. She has this little quip that she talks about, this high school, Chicago high school, that says that when students don't pass their exams at the end of their time there, they don't get a grade of failing, they get a grade of not yet. And I thought it was just such a wonderful perspective there. We do treat children sometimes in inappropriate ways. We grade them in ways that are not useful to them. And I love the not yet. And I want the not yet for almost every part of my life now. And I've been actually using that lately. Having read the book many years ago, now just coming back and here I've watched a bunch of her, TED Talks and videos and whatnot in preparation for today. And it was just really wonderful to be like, you know what? I'm going to start using that in my own world and language. Is like, oh, you know what? That didn't work out so well last week. Not yet.
and not yet actually holds you to a higher standard. You know, the easy thing is to say, okay, you got an F, you got a zero. We'll move on. You don't have to think about that anymore. But not yet says the work's not done.
Yeah, and that's going to be really difficult for me because I actually use the language of grading people all the time. I will say to people like, oh, if you were being graded in school, that would be a D, right? You know, and so like, I know that I'm doing it myself. And so I need to like retrain myself to use that language more thoughtfully and using not yet, I think is just going to be really, really great for me. Linda.
But it's really, you know, when I was a child, they tried to redo the grading system so that they didn't do grades and we just got little check marks and they tried to make, and this is really the antithesis of the extremes of grading and then the other extreme of everybody's great, don't worry about it, you're all good, you all get a trophy, everybody's wonderful. That not yet is nice because it's a challenge. It's not like you're good, you're bad, this one's smart, this one's dumb. It's y'all gonna do it. It's just not, some of you haven't done it yet, so it's okay. You still have time. And our pressure in society to perform on a certain time schedule to be, I mean, I'm a 55-year-old woman who's just trying to figure out what she wants to do with her life. So I am the antithesis of this. You have to achieve something by a certain age and you better hurry up and do this. Otherwise you're going to be behind everyone else. And I don't subscribe to that anymore.
No one else should. No one else should. I mean, you know, like I've seen people at every age make remarkable progress and do remarkable things. And we sometimes forget that, you know, many of the greatest accomplishments in life came very late in life for many people. You know, I think the biggest example is like Ray Kroc. He didn't start McDonald's until after he was in his late 50s, something like that. So, you know, like, time and time again, we presume that there is some early talent that precipitated great success. And that is just the myth of accomplishment. It's the myth of ability. Ability develops. It's not born into us. And so we have to mold our capabilities and not worry so much about these things we call talents. You know, I don't even like the term talent, certainly not after having just read Mindset again. So I wanted to talk about any of the greatest takeaways that you had from the book before we close out the discussion. What was your greatest takeaway from the book, from Mindset?
To me, just like how important it is to start early in terms of teaching people. She talked about how the babies that were punished for crying immediately kind of showed that aggression to their baby peers. And, in the past, people thought that maybe it would come out later in life. It actually, the impact is immediate, and just how important it is to have people at an early age go in with a growth mindset.
Yeah, it's so there's actually quite a bit of child psychology around these topics of what happens in early life being, kind of then ripples out to the rest of your life. And it's so fascinating to see how all of those pieces work themselves out. But psychological safety being that first thing, children, when a baby looks back at its mother or father and crawls away and learns to walk, it's immediately correlated, right? The child looking back and knowing that the parent is there allows them to take the risk. And we need to remember that as adults, we need to be able to give ourselves safety, this concept of psychological safety, to take risks, to know that there's a safety net of our peers and our support network, to be able to go out there and take healthy, progress-oriented risk. And that, we have to remember that maybe we didn't have that when we were young, and that's going to be an anchor back to a negative association with risk and reward. And we have to kind of unchain ourselves. We need to take ourselves away from that a little bit to be able to grow. So great point, Hillary. Others, what was your greatest takeaway from the book?
That's a big growth mindset thing, to be able to unchain yourself from those things that you perceive were or are holding you back. A lot of people will stay in that fixed mindset because this is the way I am, and that's just the way it is. Maybe they don't want to change, but when we're stuck on those things that happened to us, the way that we were perceived as children, that's a really good way of getting a growth mindset, is by letting those things go, even if they are still haunting us.
And it's not instant. It takes time, and be compassionate with yourself and, all of that stuff. So
my biggest takeaway from this conversation, since I didn't read the book, is the not yet. I'm going to start using that on everyone I love.
So in the context of not yet, both on a personal and an organizational basis in the startup food co-op that I'm on the board of, we are beginning our journey tonight with our first discussion on how we change our orientation and our involvement of people of color. There's actually, oddly enough, food co-op started out as a black organized form of business over a century ago. And yet today, most food co-ops are heavily white. And so we're having, as an organization and as a co-op movement in general, to confront essentially a fixed mindset of this is how co-ops look, and trying to change culturally and personally and organizationally to have an open mindset in this space. For me, as with Linda, the real takeaway is not yet.
It's really difficult, and it takes time to sit with discomfort, right? Because these are big things and big topics for many of us to deal with, and they could be with the co-op, but they could be just yourself working on yourself. You have to sit with that discomfort to figure out what is the right choice, what's the right way to move, and you need to feel that discomfort, and it's okay. I mean,
Yeah, we are looking at it that way, as both personal and organizational growth.
Fantastic. Did I see you, Frank? Did you want to give us a closing thought in terms of Gray's takeaway?
I just have to echo the not yet. Adding those two simple words, makes all the difference between, you're a failure, you didn't do it, and the future. I think not yet makes it part of your future rather than part of your past.
Wonderful. With that, I'm going to close with a quote from the book, because I think it really encapsulates a lot of what Dr. Dweck is trying to put here. And so what better way than to close us out with her own words? So quote, "When you enter a mindset, you enter a new world. In one world, the world of fixed traits, success is about proving you're smart or talented, validating yourself. In the other, the world of changing qualities is about stretching yourself to learn something new, developing yourself. In one world, failure is about having a setback, getting a bad grade, losing a tournament, getting fired, getting rejected. It means you're not smart or talented. In the other world, failure is about not growing, not reaching for things you value. It means you're not fulfilling your potential. In one world, effort is a bad thing. It, like failure, means you're not smart or talented. If you were, you wouldn't need effort. In the other world, effort is what makes you smart or talented. You have a choice. Mindsets are just beliefs. They're powerful beliefs, but they're just something in your mind, and you can change your mind." End quote. And so with that, we've reached the end of our discussion today about Mindset, The New Psychology of Success by Carol S. Dweck, PhD. I've got a few announcements and then we'll close out our conversation today. So first, we host these live quarterly discussions. So if you're listening to the recording, you can join us. Simply head over to productivitybookgroup.org and you can see the upcoming books page with all the details. And so I will put up the next discussion on that page and you can find out the details and join us next time. There on productivitybookgroup.org, you'll find all of our past discussions, summary reviews, author interviews under episodes, in case you can't find any of them in your favorite podcast app, because some of them have a limit on how many episodes can show, but either way, they're all on the website. Directions on how to subscribe to Productivity Book Group are on the website. This subscribing just means, you know, having access to it in your podcast app. It's free, but they call it subscribing. But go check out Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever you want, and you can go ahead and find it there. Finally, we also have a digital community where we can all discuss books, and I encourage you all to post recommendations of books you're reading, discuss books that we are reading leading up to these discussions. So if you go to productivitybookgroup.org/community, you'll be taken to the community. You can sign up there and see you there. And with that, thanks everyone for joining us here for this Productivity Book Group. I'm Ray City Smith. Here's to your productive life. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Ray. Thank